Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The infamous Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger is the dark heart of the big new movie Black Mass, starring Johnny Depp. It tells the story of how Whitey Bulger ruled as a murdering underworld kingpin in league with the FBI, as an FBI informant, of how he used the FBI as the FBI thought they were using him. Today, the FBI is running thousands of informants across the country. This hour, On Point, informants and the FBI, from Johnny Depp's Whitey Bulger to the streets right now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know how many informants are out there, how they're used today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Black Mass, been out in the theaters for about a week. Johnny Depp getting a lot of praise for his portrayal of Whitey Bulger. Here's a little bit from the trailer for the movie Black Mass. Kevin Weeks, played by Jess Plemons, speaks with a DEA agent in order to try and earn some, take some time off his sentence.
I need to know everything you know about the Winter Hill Gang, and specifically what you know about your former boss and now fugitive, James Whitey Bulger.
Well, let's start.
In the beginning, Jim was a small-town player.
He's a very smart, disciplined man.
Take your shot, but make it your best, because I get up, I eat you. I'm at
the
table,
you can come and you. And the next thing you know, he's a damn kingpin. You know why? Because the FBI let it happen.
Because the FBI let it happen. Joining me in the studio is Dick Lehr, longtime Boston Globe reporter. He co-authored with Gerard O'Neill the book behind the Johnny Depp movie. It is Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and the Devil's Deal. He's now professor of journalism at Boston University. Dick Lehr, my old colleague at the Boston Globe, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hey, Tom. Let's get started.
Let's get started. Tell us this story. Not in Boston, people know it front to back, but around the country, they don't necessarily. Describe to us Whitey Bulger, the part of Boston he came up out of, his famous brother, and how he got going.
Yeah, it's an epic saga, a tale of two brothers in many ways, because Whitey has a younger brother named Bill, who in the 1980s was the most powerful politician in Massachusetts as the president of the state Senate. Whitey, as a young criminal, he got arrested for bank robbery and went away and did time in the 50s and early 60s for armed robbery, spent some time in Alcatraz. But when he came out in the early 1960s, what you see is a cold-blooded, hands-on killer who steadily and certainly rose up the ranks of the underworld. And as we chronicle in Black Mass and as the movie captures and dramatizes, he couldn't have done it without the help of the FBI.
How many murders attributed to Whitey Bulger?
Well, he was convicted in federal court two summers ago of 11, okay? He was charged with 19. When you talk around those in law enforcement, I've heard numbers even higher.
Those are almost serial killer scale.
Yeah, that's what some people do refer to Whitey as, a serial killer. Part of his menace and reputation was that, unlike other crime bosses who may farm out the killings, Whitey often took matters literally into his own hands and strangled his victims to death.
He came up out of South Boston, which was an Irish-American stronghold. The FBI wanted to use him to turn on the Italian mafia in Boston and beyond, the North End.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the 1960s, I mean, you have to take this sort of historical sweep now, which is part of Whitey's place in history, that he's lasted so long and has been part of it, of all of these events. In the 1960s, J. Edgar Hoover, playing catch-up, because for the longest time he denied there wasn't a La Cosa Nostra and a mafia. Finally, in the early 1960s, he faced it and made it the Bureau's number one priority. And this predates, Whitey a little bit, and because he's in prison at this time. And Hoover initiated what has since been called the Top Echelon Informant Program, where agents everywhere were encouraged to recruit gangsters and criminals, high-ranking ones, who could provide intelligence against the mafia. And in Boston, that meant tapping into the Irish gangs and working on, the north end of Boston, which was the home court of the La Cosa Nostra.
And working with criminal informants, in this case, Whitey Bulger. These days, that's going on all over the country, and we're going to be looking at that. We heard the movie portrayal of one of Whitey Bulger's enforcers, Kevin Weeks, saying, you know how he became the damn kingpin? Because the FBI let it happen. Describe that relationship for us, Dick. That criminal informant, the role that he played for such a long time, enabled by the FBI.
Yeah, and it's not kind of the faceless FBI. I mean, what's so critical here are personal human relationships. And I think what distinguishes the Whitey Bulger case and what makes it the FBI's worst informant scandal is the relationship is at the heart of it. The FBI agent Handler, who first cultivated Whitey as an informant in the mid-1970s, mm-hmm. was another son of South Boston, this, insular Irish-American neighborhood in Boston by the name of John Conley. Mm-hmm. I think with the benefit of historical hindsight, it was almost doomed to fail from the beginning, because while it was because of Conley's Southie ties and connections and his personal friendships with the Bulger family.
The local loyalty was stronger than his law enforcement role.
Absolutely. That's how he got Whitey to agree to see him and to start the ball rolling. But it was also the very element that doomed it.
It is a little bit from the new movie, Black Mass. Johnny Depp, of course, as Whitey Bulger, will talk about that. He first resists briefly being recruited as an informant, as portrayed here. Southie-born FBI agent John Conley, played by Joel Edgerton, works here to turn him around.
John, do you know what I do to Raz?
It ain't Raz, Jimmy. It's an alliance.
An alliance between me and the FBI.
No, between you and me. I can help you, Jimmy, and you can help me.
I'm not trying to clean up Southie. I love this place. I'm interested in the North End. I'm interested in the mafia, and I bet you are too.
The FBI agent saying, I'm not trying to clean up Southie, saying to Whitey Bulger, it ain't ratting, Jimmy, James, Whitey Bulger. It's an alliance. Describe, Dick Lehrer is with us. He and Gerard O'Neill wrote the book, Black Mass. Describe how that alliance worked, Dick.
Well, there's perhaps the right way and the wrong way. And almost from the get-go, the Boston story, went off track. The right way, the correct way, under the auspices of this informant program or informant handling anywhere, mm-hmm. is the agent, the law enforcement, the cops. He's in charge. He's handling an informant, and that handler, that agent, is being monitored by others in law enforcement, supervisors and whatnot, mm-hmm. To make sure the dynamic doesn't change. It's a dangerous game. It's a tough game because a criminal is always looking for an edge, always looking for an angle. And in this instance, you had a brilliant criminal.
Whitey Bulger, a very smart guy. He was reading everybody.
And he knew that Johnny Conley from the neighborhood, 10 years younger, looked up at him in awe when they were kids. So that already gives him this sort of psychological edge over the agent in this instance who's trying to manage him.
And while he was an informant, he was also a very active criminal. He'd be talking to the FBI and turning around and wringing people's necks.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing I think that goes, in this top echelon informant program. I think, at the core, it's deeply flawed and corrupt. Because
do you mean now or then?
Then and even now. Know if the top echelon, aspect of it is still in play. Because everything I've ever learned from law enforcement sources is that the best sources in terms of managing this, what I call this dangerous game, is having criminal informants who are nonviolent criminals, the mm-hmm. bookmakers mm-hmm. of the world.
Who just hear what's going on.
And even are there, an mm-hmm. eyewitness mm-hmm. to some policymaking,
but not the
bosses.
The hammers.
Yeah, not the violent enforcers, the killers and whatnot. But just almost by definition, top echelon means higher ups, guys, the enforcers, the killers, the bosses, the people who order deaths. And It seems almost insane looking back at that.
It gets messy in a hurry here. Another clip from Black Mass. The federal prosecutor, Fred Weishaupt, played by Corey Stoll, is confronting the FBI agent, the main handler of Whitey Bulger, though who's handling whom is a question here, played by Joel Edgerton. Confronts him about Whitey Bulger's life of crime and wanting to know, why is he not arrested, this guy?
How come no one has done Whitey Bulger? He seems to be involved in every crime in the city, and yet the Bureau keeps saying he's clean. It's only when another agency has an informant that I hear maybe Whitey isn't so squeaky clean.
Well, he said he's very careful. He doesn't use phones, that kind of stuff. And who did you say these other informants were?
I didn't.
Listen, from what I hear, his criminal days are all but over. His partner and him, they've gone legit.
Christ, Conley. Is Whitey never using phones and careful, or is Whitey retired?
FBI agent John Conley, as portrayed in Black Mass, covering there for Whitey Bulger, DeClaire and Gerard O'Neill wrote the story, did the reporting. FBI agents ultimately came to you to say, oh, something's wrong here.
Right, right. We had, in the late 1980s when the Globe first broke the story, which proved to be the tip of an iceberg, that there was something funny going on between Whitey and the FBI. We had been reporting around that and hearing from, Boston cops, state police and whatnot, that their suspicions, but they didn't know. They didn't confirm it. They just knew that there's got to be something to explain why Whitey Bulger hasn't been stopped for a traffic ticket in about 15, 20 years. And so we began to, check that out, and because it seemed so unthinkable to us, because that went against everything that was Whitey Bulger's reputation.
His brother, the top guy in the state house, the arch criminal.
Irish culture,
right.
We loathe informers. So
yeah.
The idea that Whitey would be doing that. But then you got into this connection with John Conley, got into this connection with the neighborhood. And then we confirmed with one and then two FBI sources that made it publishable.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world of FBI informants, from Black Mass and the infamous Whitey Bulger case in Boston to the thousands of informants out there across the country right now. DeClaire is with us. He and Gerard O'Neill, co-authors of Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and the Devil's Deal. It is the book behind the new movie with Johnny Depp, Black Mass, getting so much attention. Very powerful portrayal of a big criminal kingpin who was also all tied up with the FBI, James Whitey Bulger. You can join us this hour. Have you seen the movie? Have you read the story? Have you lived it in Boston? Do you know the story of how Whitey Bulger wrapped the FBI around his finger as a murdering informant? And what do we learn from the Bulger story about the risks of using informants? What about the rewards? And what do you think of the number of informants we apparently have running in this country right now? Is it good and necessary? Is it too much and too vulnerable to going wrong? Another little bit from the movie here, Black Mass, Johnny Depp. They're frustrated because they haven't gotten far getting rid of the Italian mafia. FBI Special Agent Charles McGuire, played by Kevin Bacon, confronts the agent Conley, who was working with Whitey Bulger, about his prized informant, Bulger.
We can't touch them because they're no longer criminals. They're professional criminal consultants. But my question to you is, have they actually given us one concrete thing that we can move on?
Just give me a break. After the desert you've been walking through, this is your ticket to the big time. All you can do is...
Listen to me, John. We've given Bulger miles and miles of leeway, and so far he's given us in return. I need a wire inside Angiolo's headquarters. That we're moving around so much, I need to know specifically where his headquarters even are. And the fact that we don't makes us look like a bunch of Keystone cops. I need evidence that I can present to the federal prosecutor.
And you'll get it.
You got 2 weeks. Then I pull the plug.
They want Angiolo, head of the Italian mob. They want to get it with the help of Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger on all kinds of crime avenues while that's going on. Miles and miles of leeway. It hasn't given them much. He ultimately did, but there was a lot of crime along the way. And the use of informants, plenty of it in the years since then. Here's CBS News' Scott Pelley, just one example, in 2012.
Five self-proclaimed anarchists are in a federal lockup tonight in Cleveland. Prosecutors say the men intended to blow up a major bridge outside the city, but they were caught thanks to an FBI informant.
Thanks to an FBI informant, and the numbers out there on those, it seemed kind of incredible. I mean, you can read 15,000, and that's just the FBI. Dick Lehr is with me in the studio, former colleague at the Boston Globe. Great to have him here with us right now. Also in Boston for a conference on all of this week is Alexandra Notopoff, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. She studied the use of criminal informants in the domestic criminal justice system, including the FBI, author of Snitching, Criminal Informants, and the Erosion of American Justice. Alexandra Notopoff, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
How many informants are out there in the hands of the FBI and beyond?
Well, you're right that they're all over the country. The FBI is just really the tip of the iceberg. Law enforcement and investigative agencies all over the country rely heavily on informants. We don't know how many there are because we don't require the government to tell us. We don't require law enforcement agencies, most of them, to keep track even of the informants that they use or how they're rewarded or the crimes that they commit. Ironically, as a result of the Whitey Bulger debacle, the FBI has some of the best regulations today, at least requiring them to keep track of their confidential human sources. But most of the world of informant use is highly unregulated and unaccountable, and so the public and the courts and even legislatures may never learn just how many Whitey Bulger stories are out there.
But we do have a sense of the scale. I'm reading here from testimony that you gave before Congress saying that the FBI, according to its budgetary request, looks like it maintains over 15,000 confidential informants. The DEA, 4,000 paid informants. These are pretty big numbers just right there, Alexandra.
Those are actually comparatively small numbers. Absolutely, the FBI tells us that they have 15,000, or at least told us that they had 15,000 confidential human sources. But we know that there are many, many more thousands of informants used across the country. The FBI and the DEA, of course, are federal agencies, and the federal government makes up a small percentage of our criminal justice system. They handle some of the most serious cases. But are really represent about 10% of our criminal justice system overall. So magnify those numbers. Think about those numbers spread out over thousands of police departments and investigative agencies, and you have a sense, of course, with respect to organized crime and institutions like that, but also with respect to the war on drugs, an enormous user and generator of informants. Many hundreds of thousands of cases.
And so we're talking maybe hundreds of thousands of informants. If 20,000 between the FBI and DEA is 10%, we're up to big numbers in a hurry. The subtitle of your book talks about the erosion of American justice. Now, informants are presented to us, as in that clip we just heard from Scott Pelley with CBS. Look, arrest is made thanks to these informants. It's a good thing. Where's the erosion of justice come in, Alexandra?
It comes in because although often we learn that certain kinds of cases could not be made without informants. That's, law enforcement tells us this. We have very little information about the flip side of the coin, how many crimes are committed by informants. Remember what a criminal informant is. It's a suspect or a defendant or a criminal offender who has cut a deal with the government in exchange for information or cooperation that may be useful. The government agrees to look the other way with respect to informant crime. And it's that deal with the devil, if you will, that's at the heart of every informant deal, that in effect we've built in to our criminal justice system this enormous loophole, and a loophole that we keep very poor track of, so we may never learn just how many crimes are being forgiven, sentences being reduced, or the kinds of havoc that that we've been talking about with Whitey Bulger. Just letting it go because those informants are considered to be so useful.
Of course, it's used again and again and again and again. Lots of callers for the two of you, Alexandra Notopoff and Dick Lehr. Steve in Middlesex, Virginia. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I would like to put it as the cliche of it takes a thief to catch a thief. You know, if someone's already got their hands dirty, to get down into that world, you really have to know what you're talking about. It maybe seem a little bit off track, but it's almost comparable to me to like what our special forces guy do in the military, because if some people knew what they were doing, they wouldn't sleep at night.
So bring on the informants. It takes a thief to catch a thief. I'll put it to both of my guests. Dick Lear, your response?
That maxim does. It is an important premise or point to make. And there is a parallel, although the stakes are very different, to journalism. You're only as good as your sources. And I think law enforcement, whose mission is public safety, needs to get and has historically needed intelligence. And recruiting and maintaining, again, a certain kind of criminal informant, a thief, in order to get another thief, there's a certain, logic to that. But it's also so widespread and so big. And again, it happens in secret. And part of that is necessarily so. But it all comes down, and I'm not sure this is well placed. You have to have a basic fundamental trust that the cops are the good guys and ultimately doing good, and the deals they're cutting are, again, for bookmaking, nonviolent things, just to keep their asset in play, but not sanctioning, overlooking, protecting, murder, mayhem, and the kinds of things that, the Bulger case has blown open in a big way that I think part of the takeaway is huge mistrust about this whole process.
Alexander Nadipov has testified that there's lots of deals going on, and it's kind of under the radar. Nobody knows what a lot of those deals even are. But what about the basic maxim, Alexander? It takes a thief to catch a thief. Our first caller says, why not use informants? That's what it takes.
Well, that's certainly been the rationale and probably the best justification for permitting these very risky deals. And what we learned from the Bulger case and from really the outrage that followed learning about just how far law enforcement was willing to go to catch a thief is that this is like any other very risky, very expensive public policy. We need a dialogue about when is it appropriate to use a very serious offender, to forgive their offenses, to turn the other way, which again is inherent in the informant deal. And when is the public good not served? So after the Whitey Bulger debacle came to light, the Congress issued a report called Everything Secret Degenerates, the FBI's use of murderers as informants. And in effect, what Congress said is, we understand that basic maxim, takes a thief to catch a thief. But that's not a license to forgive serious crimes, to let those victims' harm go unremedied, to turn every thief into an informant, to create this massive loophole. We need to be more accountable, more careful, and more responsible about this risky public policy.
Alexander, I wish you'd walk us through the details. I mean, when it works, great. But when it goes wrong, and you describe it as going wrong a lot, almost systemically, it can be pretty bad. Here, if I may, I want to quote from your testimony before Congress. You said, the government's use of criminal informants is largely secretive, unregulated, and unaccountable, especially true in connection with street crime and urban drug enforcement. This lack of oversight and quality control leads to wrongful convictions, more crime, disrespect for the law, sometimes even official corruption. Walk us through that litany and how the use of these informants produces it, Alexandra.
So at the heart of every informant deal is the government's commitment to forgive a criminal for their offenses, either retrospectively to give them a lesser sentence or drop their charges, or to tolerate their ongoing criminal activity. The FBI guidelines written by the Department of Justice, for example, articulate two tiers of what they call authorized criminal activity, tier one and tier two. These are crimes that a handler can authorize their informant to commit. So it's built right into the structure of using informants that we are tolerating crime. It is a highly secretive, unregulated law enforcement policy. Again, the FBI, ironically, has some of the best regulations because Whitey Bulger put us all on notice that this was happening at the FBI's level. But all across the country, there are many police departments who use informants without that kind of regulation, without that kind of scrutiny. Indeed, it may be up to an individual police officer or an investigator whether to turn a serious offender into an informant or not, with all the risks that entails. And it also disproportionately impacts high crime low-income communities where the war on drugs has been most rampant. We know that the use of criminal informants is prevalent in drug enforcement, And bottom line, what that means for real people in real neighborhoods is that there are a lot of folks running around who have deals with the government, trying to work off their own offenses,
yep.
who are being permitted to remain at large because they're perceived as useful. So there are all kinds of public policy risks that legislatures and the public really don't get a chance to see. What we get to hear from law enforcement typically are the victories. Look who we caught. Look at the cases we made. But we don't have a good sense of the other side of that ledger.
Alexander Natapoff with Loyola Law School says net-net more crime. Patty's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Patty, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. We had a situation in the county close to ours. I know this is anecdotal evidence. However, mm-hmm. the person had so many drug charges and kept getting no type of prosecution. And then we thought he was a criminal informant. And then it turned out he was informing. And then they used another informant to identify him as a drug kingpin. So I thought that was interesting. They turned the informants on one another. And then my question is, does a criminal informant have to keep up a level of criminality in order to be able to provide good information?
To be credible, they got to stay criminal. Alexander Natapoff, how about it? Is there kind of a poker in their back to go on doing more crime?
Often the law enforcement tells us that the best informants are the worst criminals because they have the most information, the best connections. Sometimes we see a really terrible miscarriages of justice, as your caller pointed out, because the most serious criminals have the most information to offer. They get the best deals, whereas lower-level criminals who don't have that kind of access get sort of crushed by the wayside.
You can get perverse incentives here. Markel in Springfield, Massachusetts. Markel, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a member of an organization called Arise for Social Justice in Springfield, and we've been fighting this case about a young Latino, black and Latino young man here in Springfield.
Yes.
His name is Ayub Adusaleen, and he was approached by the FBI a few years ago to spy on the Muslims in Western Massachusetts in Springfield and West Springfield and so
okay.
forth,
mm-hmm.
here in the Valley. And my question is, what cases do you see like this where the FBI makes a quid pro quo? They offer his wife $100,000 in exchange that you spy. Ayub went to the mosque and he complained to the imam and to local representative Benjamin Swan that the FBI is constantly coming after me. He went to they got to his wife and offered his wife U.S. citizenship in exchange to. If you were spy on the Muslims, have you seen any egregious situations like this that's happened across the country?
Markel, let us look at it. Alexander, I know I just have you for another minute here. What about this is where we hear a lot of informant use with the Islamic community, especially since 9/11. You hear Markel's question. What do you say?
Yes, it's a terrible problem. The government has enormous resources and the ability to pressure individuals into becoming informants. And it's sort of the flip side of the Whitey Bulger phenomenon. Sometimes we see vulnerable informants, not kingpins, mm-hmm. not serious criminals, but young people, vulnerable individuals who can't stand up to the FBI or to the government and feel terrible pressure to turn on their own communities to become informants. And we have seen across the country complaints from numerous Muslim communities and other communities that the FBI, in effect, is exploiting that vulnerability to try to get information.
Is it to an extent that people's civil rights are being abused as they're pressured to inform?
Well, the ACLU issued a report a couple of years ago looking at that precise question, and the complaint is that, yes, people's civil rights are being violated, that there's a kind of ethnic and religious profiling going on, that young people in that community are afraid that they will be targeted when they make a mistake. They incur a small, maybe a small offense, and all of a sudden they're exposed to that kind of pressure. So it's something we should all be very concerned about.
It's a big system. It's very active. Alexandria Nadipov pays a lot of attention. Professor of Law at Loyola Law School, Los Angeles, author of Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. Thank you so much for joining us, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world of FBI informants, from Black Mass and the infamous Whitey Bulger case in Boston to the thousands of informants out there across the country right now, maybe a couple of 100,000 informants we're just hearing in this hour. Dick Lehrer is with us. He's co-author with Gerard O'Neill of Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal. It is the book behind the movie out right now, with Johnny Depp. You can join us. Have you seen the movie? Read the story? Have you lived it? And what do you think of the number of informants we apparently have running in this country now? Is it good and necessary? Is it too much and too vulnerable to going wrong? Do you wonder who those maybe 15,000 FBI informants are, what they're doing? What about all the others? Could be 200,000 or more, says Alexandra Nadipov to us here. And have you worked in the world of informants? What did you learn? How much crime should informants be allowed to get away with and still work with American law enforcement, with the FBI? In the Whitey Bulger story, the Black Mass story, there are old loyalties that go all the way back to childhood. But of course, yeah, it may have been special in the South Boston case, but maybe not unique. Here's a little bit where FBI agent John Connolly, who was the main interactor with the Whitey Bulger, played by Joel Edgerton, is having dinner with his wife Marianne, played by Julianne Nicholson, when she says that he's getting too close to his informant, Whitey Bulger. Connolly says it's not like that.
He is an informant. It's my job. You know this. I've told you this. I've known him since forever.
And you certainly hold your boyhood heroes in high regard. Jimmy this, Jimmy that.
He was very good to me when I was little, Marianne. That's all you need to know.
How was he good to you, John? Did he take you trick-or-treating?
I know. It's kid stuff. To you, maybe. Yeah, I'm gonna go for a drive. Like it or not, Marianne, you married a street kid, and the streets taught me that you give and you get loyalty from your friends. Loyalty means a lot to me.
Loyalty, but it gets very messy, very bloody, and there's a lot of illegality woven all through it. Whitey Bulger, as depicted in Dick Lehrer's book and in the movie, a lot of times here seems to be the guy in charge. He's very smart. He's very menacing. Here's a scene from the movie Black Mass where Whitey Bulger, played by Johnny Depp, is at dinner with FBI agent John Connolly's house. And John Morris, played by David Harbour, is there too. They're eating steaks. And when Bulger says it's the best steak he's ever had, and he wants to know how Morris made it, what he marinated these steaks in. And after saying it was a family secret that he couldn't share, the FBI agent eventually does tell Bulger the recipe, and Bulger goes off like this.
You said to me this is a family secret, and you gave it up to me, boom. Don't look to John, because he's not going to help you. You spill the secret family recipe today, maybe you spill about me tomorrow. Is that something maybe that's a possibility?
I was just saying.
You were just saying. Just saying gets people sent to Allenwood. Just saying could get you buried real quick.
Johnny Depp is a very menacing Whitey Bulger, a Whitey Bulger in this scene in the movie, threatening the FBI agent who's supposed to be handling him, with death. We're going to hear in just a moment from Sean Henry, former top executive, official at the FBI. Dick Lehr is with me in the studio. Dick, comments and questions online for you on Facebook. Matt writes, I like the movie. I didn't know they cut deals with serial killers who are walking the streets today. The end of the movie where they showed the sentencing of all the major players was the biggest shocker. And John says, does Lehr, you think Bulger should have been able to argue at his trial that he was promised immunity, blanket immunity?
Okay, yeah, the second question. Yeah, Whitey Bulger, you know, didn't testify at his racketeering trial, and he was blocked from presenting a defense in which he said he had immunity for his crimes. Oh, absolutely. Let's have it all come out. Not enough has come out. Whitey insisted he was never an informant. You know, let's hear why, Whitey, because the mountain of evidence says otherwise. I think we've learned so much over the several decades about this scandal, but there are certain things we still don't know. And part of it goes, and as a journalist, my interest is the FBI, is the public agency. I don't think we'll ever have a true accounting because they've blocked the public from knowing the scope of the scandal, the scope of the corruption, and what's troubling, you know, all this happens in secrecy. And I think, you know, law enforcement does so much to protect our public safety. Give them credit for that. But in this whole secret world of working with informants, the message is basically trust us. And out of this scandal, you'd have to ask, why should we trust you? This went so bad for so long. It's mm-hmm. not an isolated incident. It may be the worst instance. And most importantly, the FBI is an institution. Then and even to this day, tries to spin this scandal as two rotten agents, two rotten mm-hmm. apples,
bad
John
apples.
Connolly and John Morris, mm-hmm. Instead of taking on the challenge and responsibility of examining the flawed top echelon informant program and again, fuller transparency about how something like this could go horribly wrong and how it will never happen again.
Let's put it to a man who is right there near the top of the FBI. Sean Henry joins us from Washington. Sean Henry is president of CrowdStrike Services today. It's a security technology company. He's former executive assistant director of the FBI, retired in 2012, started working for the FBI in 1987, oversaw criminal investigations there. Sean Henry, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You hear the critique from Alexandra Natapoff at Loyola Law School. She says that net-net, this is eroding American justice. People see why it gets used, but that it has a kind of corrosive effect on the quality of justice in this country over time. What about it? How do you see it, Sean, as someone who's worked in the vineyards there?
I've been sitting here listening to both Tom and Alexandra and kind of waiting to jump in here, so I'm glad I have the opportunity. I want to talk about a couple of things that Dick said, which I think are critically important. I think it's important for me to say first that I absolutely believe that what happened in Boston with Bulger and Connolly and Morris is absolutely an abomination, and there's nobody that I know in law enforcement, current or past, who would concur with what was allowed to happen in that case.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe there were two rotten apples, as Dick put it, two people who crossed the line, who were way in too deep, who exploited relationships and looked to do things well beyond anything I would ever expect any law enforcement officer to do. There have been other examples of problems with informants, but when you talk about the successes that have occurred, the violent crime, the terrorist acts, public corruption, officials that were exploiting whole communities, when you've had sources who've come forward and provided information that has allowed law enforcement to go in and eradicate, protect, keep cities and communities safe, I think you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances there and the balance. Mm. There are absolutely protocols in place. I've worked sources for many years. I've worked in investigations for many years using intelligence to allow the FBI to get out in front of crime and to proactively prevent or disrupt it rather than just trying to figure out who did it on the backside. But the concept that there are criminals running around committing murders throughout this country and the FBI is standing idly by while that happens – just to collect information. That is a complete mischaracterization of what's occurring, and it's actually somewhat offensive to people that are out on the lines working day in and day out to keep the country safe.
I mean, you've been in the middle of it. Alexandra Nadipov is a pretty respected scholar on this, has testified before Congress to this effect. She says wrongful convictions, more crime, disrespect for the law, official corruption.
I'd love to address that, Tom. So let me, a couple of things. First of all, she said at the heart of every informant deal, there are charges that are being removed. People are allowed to go on, and they may have committed crimes and they get a reduction in sentence. That's absolutely not true. First of all, there are lots of sources who are not criminals. There are people who come forward as informants who are law-abiding citizens.
Fair enough.
Who recognize something that's occurring.
Yep.
I had a big case, corruption case, actually up in the Northeast, where a citizen was a contractor, and he recognized that there were public officials taking bribes in order to give contracts, and the city was losing millions of dollars. Law-abiding citizens were losing the opportunity to compete for contracts. He came forward and worked for over a year providing information so that the FBI could collect enough evidence to successfully prosecute. There are many other types of instances where sources come forward because out of the goodness of their heart, or they see something that they believe is a misjustice. But to suggest that, you know, everybody is having charges released and people are out kind of willy-nilly, I think that that's just a complete mischaracterization of what's occurring.
Of course, we know it does go on. Dick, as you say, there is leeway to look the other way when it keeps the informant relationship healthy and alive.
Absolutely. And I guess those non-criminal informants are part of the data that you do that has been released, I'm assuming, right? That the FBI has released in terms of the numbers of informants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a good clarification. Mm-hmm. But working with criminal informants, it is a dangerous game that requires integrity and oversight and checks and balances, which in the Bulger case were horribly compromised. And there was a institutional and culture of corruption here in Boston, which is the case I know the best, because it began before Conley and Whitey. It began in the 60s with Agent Paul Rico and Dennis Condon and Joe the Animal Barboza and Stevie Fleming. This whole initial push under the top echelon informant program seemed to, again, with the benefit of hindsight and, you know, all the documents that come forward, to been just a lawless enterprise, at least here in Boston, for decades.
Callers for you, Sean Henry. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hello.
Hi, you're on. What do you know?
Well, I wish my dead friend could speak to the clown that was just paraded in front of us, justifying such activity, because there's a lot of people that suffer from this community of clowns that catch themselves and find themselves in between legitimate law enforcement and the highly criminalized element of our society.
How does the suffering emerge, Bob? How's it come? How have you seen it?
In the ways of murder, intimidation, theft.
You mean by criminals who feel protected
by legal people?
Oh, intimidation to do what? To inform?
That and more. The conversation's good, and then we have a clown that comes out and parades and promotes.
Well, I mean, I'm not looking at Sean Henry as a clown. He's worked in the FBI, and he says this is important to law enforcement, but you're saying what? There's a murky world where people get hurt.
What's the other guest on your show saying today?
He's saying he saw a lot of corruption when he dug in Boston and investigated this. Our time is short, but I definitely hear loud and clear the skepticism right there, and let me hold that, Bob. Appreciate your call. Pam in New Orleans, you're on the air, Pam.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that one of the things Alexandra said earlier is we're also talking about low-level crime, wrongful conviction, particularly at the local level, where what you're offering people is essentially a currency greater than gold, the opportunity to walk away from days or weeks or months in jail.
Yep.
Very little oversight by local policing, very poor lawyering often in the state courts. And the numbers of exonerations at high levels with death penalty cases and rape cases are astonishing. You can only imagine the number of informants involved in unjustified and wrongful convictions at the lower level if anyone ever did have the resources to do that exploration.
Pam, I appreciate your raising that. Sean Henry, I mean, I'm reading here that something like 95% of cases do not go to trial in this country. They all get kind of sorted out and swapped. Sometimes it's, you know, look, tell us about this and you can walk on that.
Well, so Tom, I mean, it's not because people are being allowed to walk. In many of those cases, the evidence against the people who are being charged is overwhelming, and they recognize that in exchange for pleading guilty, they may get a lesser sentence. If
they do a deal.
If 100% of those cases went to trial, our court system would cease functioning.
Yeah, but at least when things go to trial, we can all see what's going on. I mean, Dick Lehr's point is here that this is a trust us scenario, that a lot of deals get made and we don't really know what they are. How can we feel confident that they're good, upright?
Well, you know, we have a balance of power in this country, and there's three parts of government. In that case, there's a judicial system, there's a defense attorney, there's a U.S. Constitution that must be adhered to, there's a judge that's involved who's a part of that tripartite. I mean, this isn't done in a secret back room. There are other people that are involved who have a responsibility to carry out, protect people's civil rights and civil liberties under the Constitution. So, again, to characterize it as this big secret, I think that is a mischaracterization. This is done in a place where there are people who have visibility, and they are obligated to abide by the U.S. Constitution.
Dick, do you see sufficient transparency and a kind of balance of interests going on today?
Well, I would take it back in the world of handling and managing criminal informants. You know, no. I mean, that has to almost by definition be in secret. And that's in some ways, and I think most people would like to trust that the FBI are the good guys and that they have, you know, the public interest and public safety as their first and highest priority. But I just think in the past, you know, 10, 15 years, we've just seen too many instances when it hasn't worked in an incredibly harmful way.
But Sean says, look, you try to run all through the court system, it will be overwhelmed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I sort of see that a little bit separately. It's like turning, mm-hmm. you know, okay. flipping witnesses and stuff like that to becoming government witnesses. That's a public situation, not a confidential informant. I think they're slightly or significantly different.
I feel like we're just scratching the surface here today, but it is fascinating to see what a large volume of this goes on, how important it's become to American law enforcement when it works. Thank heavens. When it's murky, it can't help but make you uneasy. The story of Told in Black Mass about Whitey Bulger, much more than uneasy. Sean Henry, president of CrowdStrike Services, with us today from Washington, where executive assistant director of the FBI. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dick Lehr, co-author with Gerard O'Neill of Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and A Devil's Deal. Thanks for your work then and now, Dick. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. ¶¶